Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, good to be with you. In just a few moments, we'll be inviting calls for discussion about the social, environmental and ethical impact of the government's Murray-Darling Basin Water Plan. It's one thing to have a plan, it's another thing to have science, it's something else to have a social impact. What happens when they collide and what about those caught in the middle? We'll hear from those in the affected communities as well as those with an eye for the science. But first, this week there's been renewed unrest in the Christmas Island Refugee Detention Centre. And I'm sure you've seen some of the footage on news bulletins. Well, later this evening, we'll hear from Hannah Weaver in The Good Life about one of the smaller groups seeking refuge in Australia, the Mandaeans. However, in preparing tonight's story, Hannah was contacted yesterday by a leader of the Mandaean community in Australia about the present situation on Christmas Island.
Dr. Rabbi Bricka Nazareya is the head of the Mandaean Supreme Council in Sydney. There's currently only one Mandaean in the Christmas Island Detention Centre, and it's believed he's not participating in the protest. But you believe he's under threat. Why?
Yes, he contacted me recently, and he was very frightened that he might be harmed or killed by some people, because Mandaean usually live their life in pacifist way, and peace and love is always part of the Mandaean practice. And he said that he cannot participate in this protest because it may end with some violence or harm of the body. So that's against the Mandaean religion.
Who specifically is threatening him?
Some fanatic, probably some fanatic Muslims who use the same way of dealing and treating the Mandaeans as infidel or unclean people, so they cannot touch anything, cannot share with them anything, they cannot use the bathroom before them. So they feel that he's a source of Satan for them, something like that. So it is a serious situation, and I believe that these matters is a continuation of the Mandaean persecution that happened in Iraq, and now they brought these practices and treatment to the detention centers. And it happened before, probably 10 years ago, in some of the detention centers. Salah did, I think, as he told me, he did complain several times.
Salah is the name of the detainees, is it?
Yes. Salah Khalaf Az-Zuhairi.
And has he complained to the authorities?
He said he raised the matter several times, probably four or five times, complaining about the bad treatment he is facing by other detainees and the threatening that he is receiving, and the miserable life he is living. He was really afraid of something bad might happen to him.
And what was the response from the authorities?
He said there is no response till now, and he don't know what to do. That's why he tried very hard to contact me to do something for him before it's too late.
Mm-hmm. And you're his religious leader. Mandaeism is a pacifist religion. I imagine this means that the Mandaean on Christmas Island is explicitly prohibited from participating in protests?
Yes.
Have you been made aware of any other protest activity being planned?
They told him before that protest happened to participate with them, and he refused. That's why this happened. And I'm not sure. I don't think he told me that there is another protest would happen soon. But there is some kind of a direction into that to put a pressure on the government to release them or to, you know, speed the process of releasing them.
As the only Mandane currently on Christmas Island, how is he faring?
He feel alone. We got another three Mandaeans in the detention centers, but in the detention center in Christmas Island, but they are probably in different place, and he feel at this stage very lonely, under extreme stress, and he's frightened. Yes.
Dr. Rabbi Bricker Nazareya, it was great speaking with you.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Hannah Viva there with Rabbi Dr. Bricker Nazareya of the Sydney Mandaean community. And we'll hear more from Hannah and the Mandaeans later tonight in The Good Life on Sunday night. Well, the Anglican Archbishop of Melbourne, Philip Freer, last week invited former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser and commentator Professor Robert Mann to join him for a public breakfast conversation. The topic? Australian politics today. And we were invited to eavesdrop on the event. And in about an hour's time, we're going to let you hear some of that conversation. So stick around for Malcolm Fraser, Philip Freer and Robert Mann on Australian politics today. Just another of the little features we're bringing you on Sunday night. And finally tonight, if you're sticking around with us, Bill Ledbetter will be along to join us in the chat room, and we might pick up another couple of topics in the news. This week, the Vatican announced it would issue worldwide guidelines on sex abuse, and the Pope seems to have softened the Church's position on the use of condoms. Heaven forfend. That's coming up in the chat room later on tonight. Well, the ongoing controversy surrounding plans to save the Murray-Darling Basin risks putting local communities against environmental goals. For years, churches have taught the necessity of caring for the earth, but what does that mean when it's local congregations that may have to bear the cost? When pastoral care meets prophetic voice, who shall carry the day? Well, to discuss ethics, the environment and the Murray-Darling Basin, it's a pleasure to welcome into our studios once again Jackie Raymond of Catholic Earth Care Australia, Miriam Pepper from ARC, the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change, and joining us tonight online, Ambrose Doolan, a farmer from Coonabarabran, and Julie Grigg, a rural chaplain with the Uniting Church of Australia. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Good evening, John.
Ambrose, welcome to you.
Hello, John.
Thanks for joining us. Julie and Ambrose, I'll just get to hang on for a moment while we go through to remind ourselves of some of the basic issues at stake here. Miriam Pepper, you're somebody who's taken a wide interest in broader climate issues. You had some connection with the Climate Institute for some stage. Now with ARC, the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change. Let's talk first, just briefly, about the Murray-Darling Basin Commission report itself. The report was about the science of the environment in the basin. Was there anything exceptional or surprising in the report from a scientific aspect?
So the report was really talking about how much extra water is needed for the Murray-Darling Basin. The Murray-Darling Basin is under a huge amount of stress, and the water that's required to return it to some semblance of health. So the report gave a range of flows that were required to do that, and that was the premise of the report, the starting point of the report. So were there surprises in that? I think it was pretty widely known before it came out that those figures might cause some uproar, perhaps.
Disquiet,
yes, that's right.
It's essentially saying that to meet environmental baseline standards, cuts will need to be made. It goes further as to indicate the amounts of cuts in various parts of the basin. I think that's what surprised people. Hang on, they're saying we're going to lose this and they're only going to lose that. And it created a situation of potential divisiveness between different areas of the basin.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there were also some shocks, not only in terms of the different areas of the basin, but groundwater Not only the surface water too was another aspect to the report. Yeah.
Bit of a surprise when you hear, oh, I can't fall back on the bore.
Well, that's right. And there are a lot of areas that weren't affected by those, you know, suggested decreases in extraction for groundwater, but a number that were.
Jackie Raymond, your organisation, Catholic Earth Care Australia, has had a long involvement in these issues. As far back as 2004, you released a report signed by the bishops of the Murray-Darling calling for action to protect the basin. What was your aim in producing the report? And does the government's report realise some of what you were asking for?
The aim, I think, of the report was really to raise awareness across the community with all the various stakeholders that the Catholic Church and, in fact, the whole spiritual dimension of connection with the river is incredibly vital and essential to be heard. So it was really about putting together the stories from sacred scripture, from Catholic social teaching and science that delivers a message to say that actually we've been making huge mistakes with this incredible area that's our food bowl and that provides life for the ecosystems and Indigenous communities and everybody, especially in the East Coast region of Australia. So its aim really was to raise awareness within the church and more broadly in the community around all of those issues. And it called for a real change in practice, but also a real change in people's thinking and in their hearts. And I think that's where this change really has to begin for the practice to then follow. So it's taking a while for those things to connect. And the paper that came out in 2004 in many ways is quite prophetic. I think, you know, Father Dennis Edwards, who was the principal author, wrote and called for change at that time that we're now seeing come through with this basin plan.
Well, I'm also noticing from reviewing that report myself that you seem to have also been prescient on some of the issues that would cause concern. I mean, the report itself called for discussions with the farmers, with the affected communities.
Indeed. I think our approach has always been about sustainability in terms of the four main pillars, those being not only the economic and the environmental, but the social and the cultural. So those things need to be taken into consideration, and that call for social engagement that's truly collaborative is what I think has been part of the tension in releasing this basin plan. And
yes, because it raises the critical conundrum. That is, if you want to be sensitive to the communities, can you be honest about the science? Because science is a non-negotiable, Miriam Pepper, is it not?
Well, I mean, this is the issue that we're facing in one sense, isn't it? Is the question of limits. And, you know, it's often been said that the environment is not a stakeholder in that sense. I mean, it doesn't drive a bargain, so to speak. So this real question of Well, isn't negotiable? What are the limits? And coming to terms kind of with those limits. And I think that is indeed a spiritual transformation in so many ways.
The rubber hits the road for two of those who are now joining us in the program. And Ambrose Doolan is a farmer, but also a member of a Catholic congregation. And Julie Gregg is a chaplain with the Uniting Church in rural New South Wales. Julian Ambrose. Ambrose, perhaps to you as a farmer, what was the impact of the report when it first came out in your community?
Probably not a great impact where I live exactly, because irrigation is reasonably minimal here. But a lot of my friends that sort of live further along the system where irrigation plays a big part, they got quite a fright, quite a shock. Really, with the release of the report, and then I think in turn the people from the commission got a bit of a shock with the reaction of the people, because I think they really didn't expect to have such large numbers of people turn up to want to have their say. One of my friends rang up to book a place at the meeting in Griffith, and said that he had 8 employees and they'd all like to come. And the person sort of expressed surprise that so many people would like to come from one organisation when they thought perhaps they might get 50 or 100 people at the Griffith meeting. they got 6,000.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think, you know, they underestimated, you know, the shock that they would put through the communities along the river.
Do you think the reaction of the people was a reasonable one, or was it perhaps a badly informed one?
Oh, look, I think I think they're sort of, the people along the river would be as well as informed as anybody. You know, this is where they choose to make their home. They live on the river. It's sort of not an abstract concept to them. They, as well as wanting to make a living from it, they do want it to be a living river. Like it's not in their interest to run it into the ground just to make a living. So I think they're up to speed a bit on the science behind it. But I think that it was it just seemed like there was too much emphasis on, you know, environment and not enough on the people who live in that environment. And I think that's what they wanted to come out and have their say about.
Mm. Julie Gregg, you move around as a rural chaplain. What's been the response in the communities that you've moved amongst?
Oh, John, I don't think it would be a surprise to anybody to say that there's a tremendous amount of frustration and anger out there. And I think, personally, I'm incredibly disappointed that the whole thing's been set up as a contest between competing parts. And I think that's really unfortunate. I think we could be cleverer than that. I don't think that we need to have this absolute, oh, it's the environment or it's agriculture and the two can't possibly live side by side together. And I think that very way that it's been set up, the way the meetings have been held, the very long drawn out process of the report. So the report was supposed to come out before the federal election. It was delayed for a number of months. Now we have the guide to the draft report, then we're going to have the draft report, then we're going to have the report itself. We're looking at a lengthy, drawn-out process. All these things actually increase that level of frustration and anger that there is in the bush. And I think, you know, from the church's point of view, we need to be thinking a bit more about how we can help equalise some of that stuff and help people through that sort of process.
The minister, Tony Burke, was pretty quick out of the blocks within a couple of days of saying, no, we will have a look at this, and got another set of advice against the commission. The commission said, look, we were only chartered with looking at the science. He then comes around and said, no, we've got other legal advice. Legal advice says we can look at the social and economic impact under the guidelines. Miriam, was this a bit of a mess up as far as environmentalists are concerned?
Well, I mean, it's been very interesting to see that not only do we now have an inquiry from the government, it's a Senate inquiry, I believe, into the social impacts, but the Murray-Darling Basin Authority itself is also conducting its own inquiry into the social impacts around the guidelines to the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. So, I mean, I guess from my perspective, it's been interesting to see how the authority reacted to that and how it reacted to this advice around the Water Act and reinterpretation of the Water Act, and saying themselves, well, we got advice, similar legal advice before we released this, and we understood that we were, you know, operating within the framework of the Act and what we were required to do. I think I agree with Julie in terms of what she's saying about the way this is set up as a contest. I guess I would also say, though, that the starting point in terms of this plan also is understanding the need for a viable Murray-Darling Basin, a healthy basin that's able to support communities. And sometimes when we talk as if they're at loggerheads, the basin and the communities, as if they're at loggerheads, we forget that the starting point is the viability of that eco-social system as a whole, I suppose.
It's a long-term versus a short-term, though, in some ways, isn't it? That is, people will say, some will say, look, we've got to look at this as an issue of long-term viability, and that means X number of changes have to be made. And others say, no, hang on, I've got my short-term profitability or survivability to worry about. And those two things may, in fact, conflict. Jackie, this is where a report such as the Bishop's report does have a gap in it, because it recognises that changes are needed, but it doesn't get to the nitty-gritty, that some people are going to be hurt, and what's our role in this?
That's true. I think what it's about is enabling an understanding of the deep interconnectedness between all of the things that the water and all of the species that are supported by it and the people along it are so deeply interconnected, and that we often break it up into fragments rather than seeing it as a whole basin and a whole river system. However, when it comes to, you know, we're 6 years down the track from this report being released, this is when the rubber is hitting the road, and it is quite challenging because, of course, in our community there's that diversity of interests and opinions around what people would like to see happen, and people who don't want to relinquish their licences around water and irrigation because the way that they've been operating, they see that as being necessary for survival. Whereas those others that you might speak to, such as Ambrose, who's on the line tonight, who's spoken about changes he's made because water hasn't been there through the drought period and they've had to not use the river in the way that they used to, have found that it's actually quite fine. That they've, yes, it was challenging initially, but once that change was made, they've actually been producing really viable crops.
Ambrose, do you think changes can be affected and people are open to education towards change?
Oh, my word. I think that's just something that probably, if you're just talking about, you know, like just cuts in, you know, thousands of megalitres or whatever, you sort of closing off another avenue which could be more productive for the river and more productive for the people is if we sort of concentrate more on efficiencies so that people can do more with less rather than just concentrating on the less part.
Yeah, and efficiencies over a wide scale take a fair amount of time to develop. And
well,
people
do.
Are afraid that they won't have the time to implement those
well,
efficiencies.
Well, they do, but it's a very old country, isn't it? I don't think we, you know, it's taken us 200 years to get to here. I don't think we can have it fixed by Christmas. And if we just take a slightly longer term view and concentrate on those efficiencies, probably in my point of view, rather than so much the cuts, and you know you can get the water back to the river and not be cutting back, you know, production, and then, you know, the lives that people have built along the river, which aren't all, they're not all farmers, you know, like the people, a lot of the people that went to that meeting in the southern part of the state, like Griffith, they're not all farmers. They might have a shop, they might be a hairdresser, but they're all interrelated. And if we just sort of concentrate on just the farming angle, I think you're sort of cutting, you're not taking the whole view, which is the full view of the people that are affected by what happens along the river.
Yes, the knock-on effects are quite large. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia, through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. We're talking about ethics, environment and the Murray-Darling Basin, a report on Australia's largest river system, suggesting that unless we modify the way we use water in the Murray-Darling Basin, then not only will those rural communities around the basin suffer, but long-term Australia's entire agricultural system could be at risk, and the health of the environment generally. Our guests are Jackie Raymond from Catholic Earth Care Australia, Dr. Miriam Pepper from ARC, the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change, Julie Gregg, Uniting Church Chaplain, and Ambrose Doolan, a farmer. If you'd like to join the conversation, please do. 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222, on ABC Radio around Australia. Let's talk about a reasonable baseline. People have suggested, and the report suggested, that look, you know, there are different baselines maybe in different areas, but when it gets tough, Miriam, a baseline is a baseline. You can have an upper limit and a lower limit, and people are suggesting that even the lower limit is too great an impact.
Yeah, I happened to watch Landline today, actually, and what was being talked about in part there was, is it possible to better manage environmental flows so that, you know, rather, for example, than a wetland only receiving water when the river tops the bank, you can actually pump water into the wetland when the river is lower. So there was this idea of kind of managing environmental flows better. And so then that would put into question the lower limit, I suppose. Certainly groups like ACF, Australian Conservation Foundation, have said that the Murray-Darling Basin Authority needs to be modelling the upper end of that range instead of just the lower end of that range, which is what they've done to date. An interesting thing about this idea of kind of managing those environmental flows, and we talk, I guess, often in religious thought and Christian thought about our relationship to the environment, about stewardship, dominion, and this idea of to what extent can we control, I suppose, to what extent can we can control and shape our environment.
Master it.
Mastery, yeah, indeed. And so I'm very interested to hear this conversation around managing these environmental flows in a quite interventionist mastery kind of a way, and to what extent, and so how low can you go?
You reduce the wilderness to a park.
Well, yes, in a way. And it was certainly around, you know, reducing this lower limit to as low as possible.
Mm. Ambrose, these are serious ethical issues. You're a member of the Catholic Church. You take the Church's teaching on these things seriously. How do you wrestle with those sort of judgments?
Well, I don't think that they're totally, you know, at odds with one another. I think, you know, like reading from the report, and we had actually within the sermon there today, that we're not constrained by the laws of the land. There's actually a higher law that we're bound by and that we'll be called to account to, which is, I think it'd be more like stewardship rather than mastery of the land. I think, you know, we've been given the gift of this water, and I think, from my point of view, we're to make something of that gift. We're not just to let it sort of wash on by and go past out to the sea, but then at the same time, we're not to ruin the environment either. So
in some ways, too, you're a custodian for future generations, aren't you? You're holding it in trust, in a way.
Well, I think we're called to do that. I think we have to be fair. Like, fairness has to, or balance has to be from all angles. Like, the people who live higher up the river have to be fair to the people at the bottom, and the people at the bottom of the river have to be fair in what they expect to come down. And then we all have to be fair to the people who will be here in the future. So that is right. Yeah, you have to be, I think, balance and fairness have got is what we're aiming for.
Julie Gregg, as a rural chaplain, these ethical issues are going to become more and more your daily fare over the next few years, I should imagine. Are you planning some ways of beginning to deal with them to help the discussion process along?
John, I think lots of people in the bush are already and have already lived with these ethical issues for a very long time. In preparation for tonight, I actually talked to some young farmers who live on the Lachlan River, which is where I live, and what they wanted to talk about was that for them it's about leaving their land to their children, and what they want to leave to them is got to be better than what they've got now. And that was their focus. Their focus was on the future. It was on the long term. It wasn't just, you know, you talked earlier about the short term making a quid. That wasn't what they talked about at all. They actually talked about wanting the environment to be better, wanting it to be better for their kids. They were second and third generation farmers, and they wanted that to continue. And I think lots of farmers have a really long-term view of where they live and what their land has been like. And I think part of the frustration in this debate is they feel that their knowledge of the Murray-Darling Basin hasn't actually been taken into account. Many of these are second, third-generation farmers. They know what the rivers looked like from what their grandfathers have told them, or their grandmothers, or whoever, you know, their family members that have been there. They know that just having permanent water in these rivers is not necessarily what they were like. I mean, the Lachlan wouldn't have ever been permanent water before we put dams on it. There are lots of pictures of people picnicking in the bottom of the Murray River in the 1920s before we put dams along it. By actually saying things like we've got to have permanent water in these rivers all the time, we're actually changing the environment. But people on the ground haven't got a way of having their voice heard. So that leads to their frustration as well, because it's like, no one will listen to me. If I don't have a PhD and I can't write doctor in front of my name, no one wants to hear about the wisdom and the knowledge that I've got. And that's a major problem. And I think the other ethical thing that we haven't explored tonight at all yet is the fact that growing food is a strong biblical principle. And we need to be growing food, not only for Australia, but a lot of our food goes overseas. We haven't grown rice for a while in Australia because of the drought in the Murray-Darling Basin. And that's impacted hugely on people in Malaysia and the Philippines who rely on our rice to help feed their people there, and has caused great hardship. And as a church, we can't ignore the fact that other people in the world suffer when we don't grow food. People in Australia probably won't. They've got enough money to buy it from somewhere else, and there's lots of environmental reasons why we should be growing food closer to home rather than importing it from overseas. But we also need to take into account that the rest of the world also relies on Australian produce as well. And with the world population growing, that will become more and more important.
You've raised several issues there. One could take the cynical approach or the sort of noble approach to a number of them. On the issue of long-term view and better than now, one could easily imagine somebody, and let me be the devil's advocate for the moment, take the view that, look, I need to have this land preserved for my kids and their kids, so I've got to make sure that the most water possible stays available to me, which would be a short-term benefit me and my family, but long-term maybe ending in 50 or 100 years' time the future of the river. Now, I'm not saying that people are taking that attitude. I'm saying that's a possible view. The other view that comes into play there is and this is the question of local experience. Local experience is being challenged over the last 10 years by the drought. Some say it has, some say it hasn't. But the question that still arises here is the wider global question. Is this a localised drought, or is it part of an ongoing, subtle and slow but irreversible shift in the climate? And Miriam, this is where your wider issues, as somebody who's interested in climatology and the environment, comes into play against the dynamics of, are we dealing with a localised phenomena that's been repeated cyclically through history, or are we dealing with something that has impacts that could actually be heralding something that's permanent and structural?
Yeah, and this is a huge challenge for us, certainly, because we're looking, you know, with the Murray-Darling Basin plan, we're looking again at trying to restore this basin to health under the pressures that it's been on to date. And then if we add climate change to that, which again, many would say we're already seeing the impacts of that now. And the CSIRO projects that there most likely will be a decrease in water availability in the southeast of Australia, which puts the whole system under increasing pressure. And then we're talking here about global issues meeting regional issues, meeting local issues as well. And of course, then it's not only about the Murray-Darling Basin. It's about Australia as a whole, and it's about all the global politics around climate change. And it's often been said, you know, that Australia is the developed nation that will be most affected by climate change.
Gives a whole new meaning to think global, act local, doesn't it, really? I mean,
yeah,
it does give the sort of the real acid edge to that, doesn't it? Jackie, you're nodding your head. These issues must be playing with your wider discussions as well.
Absolutely. I mean, excuse me, the whole issue of climate change is one that the bishops focused on, particularly in 2005 with a statement around that. And Catholic social teaching tells us that the climate is a good that needs to be protected. And it reminds us whether we're in a role of industrial consumerism or
at a local level of how we actually leave our footprint on the earth in terms of what we use and make use of, that we actually have a moral responsibility to reduce our footprint and to protect this great good of the climate. So I think Catholic social teaching offers a whole lot of different guides for us in this area. One of the things that was just raised previously by the Uniting Minister was about how to give a voice to people on the Murray-Darling. And just in this last week, I've been contacted by a student from Canada who's actually studying there, but he's an Australian from the Wangaratta region. And he's proposing a project where he's going to kayak up the river, so upstream, taking the opinions and the projects and the voices of people along the river to communities, whether they be schools and local communities.
So the voice from downstream moves upstream.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very worthy project to support. So we've started talking about how we can make that happen next year.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Time to take your calls. Lots of calls on the board. Let's go to Dennis first. Hello, Dennis. Welcome. What would you like to say?
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, well, I'm on the side of the Murray-Darling farmers. Now, a few points. Again, we see religion sticking their, what I call, beaks to issues that are theirs. Now, also, you had a farmer there from Coonabarabran, I believe it was, who also puts this, what I would call, stupid environmental idea, and please remember that New South Wales is no longer in drought. It's been one of the wettest years ever on record. But my concern is, I note that you did not get a farmer that is directly affected to be interviewed in the Murray-Darling area. Now, also, what I call extreme environmentalist idea about the Murray-Darling, it'll more destroy that area. And I'd like to say that the farmers are much more environmentalist than what these extreme environmentalists are.
Dennis, thanks for your observations. Just picking up on a couple of those points. Miriam, Jackie, I'll get you to respond to what Dennis is saying, because there is still a widespread community scepticism about these issues, which does seem to feed some of the populist attitudes to it. How do you deal with that and keep a responsible dialogue going?
I think it really represents the disconnect that people have between within themselves around where their food comes from, where their water comes from, and understanding and appreciating that what we're drawing upon here is a gift from God that we see is meant for all. And so it really is about saying, well, yes, farmers certainly who are living on the land, no doubt appreciate and have a deep connection with their country. But we're looking at the basin as a whole here, and we're looking at what's fair across the basin, so that people downstream who are suffering the ill effects of the river not even reaching its mouth at times are really, you know, losing everything. Whereas places upstream like Cubby Station that have been hoarding water for years now have been getting away with that. It's just not right. It's such an issue of you know, moral integrity that I think, you know, it's good to hear the perspective that Dennis brings, but I also think the work that needs to be done is really about changing our mindset and our hearts.
Ambrose, your experience, how's the discussion go about areas like Cubby Station? Does that enter into the popular discussions that you have?
Not really. I think, to be fair to Cubby, really, they've got some big dams, but they've been empty along with the river, really, for the last 2 years. It's been a lack of rain more than anything else, really, the last few years. There was the program like Two Men in a Tinny.
Yep.
There a couple of years ago, and they had John and Tim, wasn't it?
John and Tim, it was.
Yeah.
John Doyle and Tim Flannery.
Yeah, bobbing around in the river there saying, you know, it was a bit empty and how could this have all happened? And then I listened to one of the mayors from Western New South Wales interviewed on local ABC radio, and he said, well, you know, it's just that it hasn't rained. It's been like the driest 10 years forever.
There so people, do, Ambrose, there. Do people see more this as a function of a drought, a periodic drought, or as betokening that there may be fundamental climate change in the air?
Well, probably more the drought as much as anything. I think probably the majority of farmers would probably, you know, probably 60-40 would be in the drought as opposed to climate change camp, I would say. But even if they're a bit sceptical of climate change, the practices that they're adopting on their farm so that they can be economically and environmentally sustainable, if the rest of society made such improvements over the last 10 or 15 years, you know, like our footprint as far as carbon goes would have shrank rather than increased, you know, like their minimum till farming practices have sort of cut their fuel inputs by, well, I know in our own case here, by 70%. You know, if the rest of society could match a 70% cut in their fuel, where would we be today? You know,
A few lessons need to be passed on to we city folk.
So whether you might be doing it for a different reason, but the outcome surely is pleasing to us all, you would think. So I think so. I think there probably could be a bit of a disconnect with what people think is happening to what actually is happening.
Good. Let's take another call. Dennis, thanks for your call. We'll go to Peter in Queensland. Peter's also a geologist. Hello, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good day, everybody. Look, I'm a little hesitant to say what should be done because I've only been there as a visitor. I paddled from Warwick down to St George about a decade ago, and I experienced the most extraordinary hospitality from everyone. So it's a bit of an attempt to return that. I'm in the drought as opposed to climate change camp. I've spent the last decade looking at what's driving this thing, and the people that believe it's carbon aren't going to like what I'm saying. But we have an enormous amount of data from the satellites, 280 CO2 maps, showing no match between carbon dioxide and the temperature warming. But what we do have is the very deep geophysics shifts are matching the temperature shifts. And the reason it's relevant to the Murray-Darling is that you get these magnetic shift lobes come up from the South Magnetic Pole. They come up through Australia. There's been one under the Murray-Darling Basin for probably 100 years. It's now decaying. And the temperature hotspot that sits over it and matches it also seems to be decaying. I'm not absolutely sure about this, but that's my best shot at it. Now, I think what that says is that we don't know what happens in the next 100 years. You know, the maps, if you go to the long pocket maps the last 114 years, you see the rainfall is incredibly variable, but as your previous people said, it's cyclical. So I think it would be, it's probably wise. I want to say I've also been a professional greenie, and this is going to sound strange, but it's probably wise to chance our arm, give the farmers and the communities a bit more water than would otherwise be sensible, and hope that it comes good, because what looks to be happening is it'll cool. Whether that brings more rain or not, I don't know. You know, this magnetic change hotspot shifted to off the West Australian coast. Maybe they're going to get a lot of heat now. We don't know what comes next. So, you know, as opposed to the carbonist model, which is bleak pessimism, all we can say is we're now faced with complete ignorance. We don't know. So maybe we can mothball the towns and the villages and the farms if it doesn't go well. You know, have a police presence there to prevent vandalism. Those people who want to stay be supported on public expense to stay if it really goes dry, and the working population move out with a view to coming back again.
It sounds a pretty bleak prospect from looking at it that way, Peter. I'll just get Miriam's response on the, given you've raised the issue of whether it's cyclical or structural. Miriam, you probably would like to respond to a couple of the things that have been raised there by Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea about giving irrigators more water, that's a very risky approach to take. I would also say that we're making a false opposition here if we say if it's drought or if it's climate change. We know the Australian environment is cyclical. Absolutely, you know, of droughts and flooding rains, as they say. And so, but there's a question about climate change making them more prolonged, more often, and more severe. So we know Australia is a country of drought, and surely, if nothing else, we don't want to deal too foolhardy with the risk that we're facing around that. Absolutely.
So you're suggesting the precautionary principle there is overwhelming in its force.
Absolutely. And look, we've modified the Murray-Darling Basin to such a great extent. I mean, we face the issue of dealing with the existing pressures, let alone the pressures through climate change. Another thing I just want to say briefly as well is that, and we've talked about, Ambrose raised this issue about farmers stepping up to the plate and improving their practices. I believe that city people absolutely want to support that and are behind that. My own church is involved with something called Food Connect, and that supports farmers in the region who are growing food organically or chemically free. 40% of what you pay for your fruit and veggie box goes to those farmers. And so people absolutely want to support that, and people in the cities are starting to grow food themselves. You know, we're hearing about this renaissance of food growing in the city. So I think that's not, often it's presented as city versus farmers. I think that's totally breaking down.
But that's an educational process, which it's community organisations, well, yes,
experiential process.
But community organisations like churches are, this is a primary opportunity for churches, isn't it, Jackie, in some way, to actually get back into saying, look, this is about real things in the real world.
Yes, and let's model what that means in terms of having a place for the common. So some of the parishes that I've been working with, like in South Melbourne, who have been putting in place vegetable gardens and setting up food co-ops and enabling places for children to be looked after. So it's a real community place. So having an organic cafe there is really a new way for us to think about church and how we gather. And in our schools, we've got kitchen gardens being developed and grown, whether they can get funding from the Stephanie Alexander program or not. So I think there is a great shift that's happening at that grassroots level in our communities, which is just something we really encourage.
Let's take a call from Matthew. Thank you, Peter, very much. To Matthew in Canberra. Hello, Matthew. Welcome.
Oh, hi, mate. How are you going?
Good. Well, yeah, briefly, if you can.
Yes, I've found over the last at least 20 or 30 years there's been quite a lot of talk along the river of, the possibility of reductions in allocations and water theft and all sorts of other issues. And I think it's just a great thing that there's going to be a nationwide approach to it. I guess it's a federal government department because there's been so much variation along the river with water use. I just think it's a sensible idea to get it all under one umbrella, so to speak. Also, I find it a bit curious with the Christian element. I mean, I'm an agnostic. Actually, I've changed religions. I used to be an atheist, now I'm an agnostic. I think it's about looking after the earth, of course. Go the Murray-Darling Basin Authority.
Good on you. Thanks for that observation. You're on Sunday night. We're going to have to wind this up. We've only got a minute or so left. But Julie and Ambrose, I'd like to pick up on the point that was just made about this: the need to get people along the river talking. That is from top to bottom, from South Australia, where the perceptions of those at the top end are quite different, and each side sees the other. So there's this, not only is there an education about the issues, but there's an education about people and communities, and I guess the roles that you have as being members of wider communities such as the church are vitally important here. Julie?
Yeah, I think it is very important that we recognise that everyone who lives in the Murray-Darling Basin has to share in what's going to happen for the river. It can't, the emphasis on who's going to be hurt most by it cannot just be borne by farmers. I mean, we can't just say to Melbourne and Adelaide, you get as much water as you need and we will take it from elsewhere. The cost of putting more water into the environment has to be borne equally by everyone across the river. And I think we have a role as a church, as the broader church, to be making sure that we're in that debate to ensure some fairness in the process. And I think some of that fairness is lacking at the moment.
Just a final word. We'll have to get out of this. We've only got 30 seconds to go. Ambrose, what's your ambition for the next few years in this debate?
Oh, look, I think we can, if we get our heads together, I think we can provide the water for the environment without closing down the bits of Australia that are sparsely populated as it is, and sort of without turning them into a museum piece, I think we can keep them humming along with that triple bottom line.
And so say all of us. Ambrose Doolan, Julie Gregg, Miriam Pepper, Jackie Raymond, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Night.
Thanks, Ron.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.